least I am. You think maybe first and second grade should have a little, you know, field day by themselves in the park where we sort of choose a team from all? You think, you know, so many of the children have older brothers and sisters, and we have been working on the phys ed program this year. It might be a nice kind of thing. Should we maybe get together, Alva, and see if we could work something out? For after, you know, after last week of school or something.
Well, I'll tell you what I'd hope to do. I'd hope by this time to have opportunity to go back over all of our previous discussions, make a digest of what we've done so that sort of refresh our minds, before we go on. But I just haven't had a chance to do it, and I do expect to before we're finished, so that our discussions are put into some sort of orderly form. But we had been discussing the unit, and we'd gone through the various stages of the unit organization, and I thought that this was a very good time to take up the whole question of thinking. And here again, I'm going to rely very heavily on this, which I think is a very, very wonderful book, Education for Effective Thinking. Have you had it in any of your courses?
No.
Education for Effective Thinking.
It's been referred to, but you know, not as a text. But
and what I want to talk about is an approach. An approach to thinking, not that in the, and to problem solving, not that in the class you do this by a formula and you you have a procedure which you follow A, B, and C, but rather this is the theoretical approach. This is Dewey's description of the thinking process, and it helps us to have a point of reference, I think, and to make us more conscious and aware of how it goes on in our classes. And his summary is this: that the thinking, the origin is in some perplexity. We may recapitulate by saying that the origin of thinking is some perplexity, confusion, or doubt. Thinking is not a case of spontaneous combustion. It does not just occur. There is something specific which occasions and evokes it. General appeals to a child or to a grown-up to think, irrespective of the existence in his own experience of some difficulty that troubles him and disturbs his equilibrium, are as futile as advice to lift himself by his bootstraps. Now, in this particular approach of Dewey's, there's one thing that I think that he has conspicuously left out. And to my mind, with many children, a very important incentive to thinking is just simple curiosity. Maybe if you analyze the personality, you'll find the basis of this in some perplexity, confusion, or doubt. But seems to me human beings, at least when they're young and fresh and exuberant about life, that there is a natural curiosity there, that they just want to know what makes the clock tick and so on. But anyway, this is beside the point.
You want it to be technical when you have to decide what is curiosity.
Yes, yeah. And then you get back to that, and maybe you get back to some of these definitions. But then the next step is a tentative plan is based on analogous experience and prior knowledge. Given a difficulty, the next step is suggestion of some way out, the formulation of some tentative plan or project. the entertaining of some theory which will account for the peculiarities in question, the consideration of some solution for the problem. The data at hand cannot supply the solution, they can only suggest it. What then are the sources of the suggestion? Clearly past experience and prior knowledge. If the person has had some acquaintance with similar situations, if he has dealt with material of the same sort before, suggestions more or less apt and helpful are likely to arise. But unless there's been experience in some degree analogous, which may now be represented in imagination, confusion remains mere confusion. There's nothing upon which to draw in order to clarify it. So this is the second stage, to think up some tentative plan. And then, the next point, plan not accepted until carefully examined and criticized. If the suggestions that occur is at once accepted, we have uncritical thinking, the minimum of reflection. To turn the thing over in the mind to reflect means to hunt for additional evidence for new data that will develop the suggestions and will either, as we say, bear it out or else make obvious its absurdity and irrelevance. Given a genuine difficulty and a reasonable amount of analogous experience to draw upon, the difference par excellence between good and bad thinking is found at this point. The easiest way is to accept any suggestion which seems plausible and thereby bring to an end the condition of mental uneasiness. Reflective thinking is always more or less troublesome because it involves overcoming the inertia that inclines one to accept suggestions at their face value. It involves willingness to endure a condition of mental unrest. Reflective thinking, in short, means judgment suspended during further inquiry, and suspense is something painful. The most important factor in the training of good mental habits consists in acquiring the attitude of suspended conclusion and in mastering the various methods of searching for new material to corroborate or to refute the first suggestion that occurs. He goes on to examining various theories of thinking and comes up with this summary of reflective thinking or problem solving. Number one, a situation for which the answer is unknown but can be found, a situation which challenges but does not baffle the individual seeking the answer. Number two, a period of inquiry, long or short as the case may be, in which the confused, indeterminate situation is transformed into a unified and determinate one. And in this process, terms and limits are defined and redefined. Suggestions arise from many sources and are deliberately sought for in others. Discussions, arguments, differences of opinion, exchange of fact and belief take place. Digressions, blind alleys, useless suggestions and leads intermingle with valid and conclusive items. Careful inferences from data, hunches, insights and bold guesses intermingle with one another. Plans are made and remade, abandoned, adapted. Much time is consumed and much scrap thought is characteristic. The errors indicated in previous points are not always recognized immediately, nor are correct leads. Right or wrong points must often be pursued for some time before validity or lack of it can be determined. Many schemes for analysis, for comparison, for organization are made, improved, abandoned, adopted. Ideas once abandoned may be recalled later and prove useful after all. Then, the third step, a conclusion is formulated, checked or corrected, and stated in terms referring directly to the original problem is finally defined. The conclusion is good as far as the facts and reasoning at the time go. It is the truth until further facts or closer reasoning appears which may destroy, modify, or corroborate it.
You know, Norman, that's what's wrong with programmed learning. It just struck me. This whole second step is left out, you know? There isn't that exchange of ideas. You're going along with
that
this.
Exploring.
Yes.
Stumbling, fumbling,
yeah.
Discarding.
And then taking back. Finding.
And hearing other people's, the social...
And the stimulation.
Yeah.
Norman, would you be able to run this off for us like you did some of
the
questions?
Yeah, yeah.
But this is all, you know, it's so nicely put in an organized fashion.
There are different kinds of problems which commonly initiate critical thinking. The first kind of problem is to find the answer for a real or theoretical or speculative problem.
Does he give any examples in there?
Well, he will now. He says, common to the physical sciences, to certain levels of technology, and to many everyday activities beyond the trivial or routine. It usually proceeds through suggestion, development, and testing of hypotheses. Problems may be one of explanation, discovery, verification, evidential summary. You have a real or a theoretical or a speculative problem, and you have to verify it, and you test the hypotheses and so on. Then the second kind is to determine what to do in a given situation, the immediate overt action to take in practical affairs. Common in all everyday affairs, deals with any kind of subject matter and results in a practical judgment. This is the kind of thing you're always having in discussion periods in class. Usually proceeds through considering one hypothesis or two alternative hypotheses, rarely a great number. Knowledge is summarized and weighed in light of consequences and decision made. That's a practical situation, and to know what action to take. Shall we have this rule in the playground, or shall we not? Three, to determine goals, attitudes, or policies to control future actions, to reconstruct goals, attitudes, or policies. Common to social sciences, to public affairs generally, to ethical and moral decisions. Usually proceeds through an exchange of views in group discussion, tentative conclusions being set up for trial decisions, leading eventually to a meeting of minds or consensus. Hypothesizing may or may not be prominent. Testing is usually postponed as trial of policy is longer and less subject to control than scientific hypotheses. Four, to choose between policies or goals already formulated, to determine the validity of conclusions, beliefs, or opinions expressed by others, to give reasons for supporting one's own expressed belief. Common to situations in type three above, also to analysis of editorials, columns, speeches, advertisements, public or private expressions of any kind, usually proceeds through examination and evaluation of facts, inferences, sources. Through search for assumptions, for bias, for lack of these things, through search for purposes of speaker or writer, through evaluation of the background and affiliation of the speaker or writer. Much of this pamphlet is of that, isn't it? Assumptions.
Yes.
Endorsement of opinions and. This kind of thing in the process of evaluating different beliefs or goals. Number five is to create something new, unique, not heretofore known. Six, to draw logical inferences from accepted postulates and axioms, logical proof. Seven, to make value judgments in ethical and aesthetic fields. Each of these types of thinking then involves somewhat different procedure, and I think the value of bringing this up is that you recognize that when you are handling a problem of behavior in the class, or when you're determining who spilled the water, you have a somewhat different procedure of logical thinking than when you're determining which is the right approach toward testing atomic devices. That there are different procedures and different methods for different kinds of critical thinking. I think that whether you're teaching first grade or eighth grade, And whether you're going to use, actually use these situations in your class, that a consideration of this is very important. Because once you get a feeling for the techniques of critical thinking, and on an adult level, then you can see what is relevant to the children of the age that you're handling. I'm almost tempted, Bill, to take that problem we've been wrestling with and use it as a laboratory thing and see what we can do with it here, because we had a thorny problem that we've been wrestling around in the halls and so on, and I think the only value of any situation that we bring up here would be to look at ourselves, to think, and also to think about the process of how we thought, and think about how we clarify, and to clarify our own thinking in that way. However, I don't know. I don't know whether we could even present the problem in the time that we have. Does this so far? Does this arouse in your mind any situations or examples or concrete problems that you you would like to discuss at this point?
It would be good if we could. At least we could have a couple of examples that use in our course. I know I'm doing reports this year, I tried my reports, and based on the workshops that we had, based on Preston and our experiences here, you know, it's helped me tremendously in thinking through different children. The ones that really, I've already come in from the workshops we had in the past on critical thinking, and logical thinking, I have found that at first grade level, things that I was not aware of in previous years, that I have found this year in children, and I'm sure it existed other years, only I was not aware of it. As an example, of Freddie Conrad, a child who thinks so, his relationship thinking, his ability to think logically, and then discard what he had thought because he's found out new materials. I mean, he's a good example, and I have notes upstairs on some of the of his thinking that really almost follows a pattern of what Norman was just outlining.
I'll give you a simple little example of how I'm using this currently with that group of yours in science. We were studying the magnet, and they did a lot of experiments with the magnet, and the final one being to put the paper over a magnet and to sprinkle iron filings and see the pattern. Well, I thought about this. Now, each child had a battery and some wire. I said, now we're going on to electricity. And there is a similarity between electricity and magnetism. Now, there I immediately gave them an idea, which I'm thinking now, just thinking out loud of my own thinking process. In other words, I handed them a concept, a conclusion, yes. But in order to go on, I felt I had to do that. I said, there is a similarity between magnetism and electricity. Could you set up an experiment to show that? Now, here is what he says about setting up a hypothesis that includes previous things. They had to think back over what they did with magnetism and apply it to the present unknown situation and try something to set up a hypothesis. One child thought of connecting the wires and then putting the paper over the wires. The others thought of connecting the wires and just touching it to a paper clip, which was one of the first things. But this most complex conclusion was this one that thought of making the putting the wire flat on the table and putting paper on it and putting filings on it. So there is an example of critical thinking, taking the hypothesis was that that there is a similarity, and that hypothesis they took for granted at that moment, and then the previous experience which was brought in to clarify the situation was what they had done with the magnet, and then an application of that, and then it was a testing, and then the conclusion was that electricity does behave the way magnetism has some of the same properties.
I don't think there's anything wrong to give a conclusion. I mean, as you say, Norman gave a conclusion.
You have to do this
in order to stimulate. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that in their findings they may find things that would disprove. They might find in a conclusion that we give, because nothing is. Things are always subject to change.
Yes, and I think that in our life there this is incidentally, technically, this is an assumption. Mm-hmm. I gave them this assumption.
Mm-hmm.
But life is full of assumptions. Life is full of unproved assumptions. And that's part of critical thinking, too, to see what your assumptions were. For instance, in all of our discussion now, to go back to our staff meeting here as a procedure, we started out with the assumption that critical thinking is valuable in education. We just took that assumption. We didn't even think about it. It was so much a part of our, and we didn't test it. We just and of course one of the important things is to lay bare these assumptions very often.
We had an example yesterday, simple, and it was a discussion of how butter was made in New Amsterdam, the churning and so on. And I raised the problem of how would butter be stored? Well, the children remembered that the Indians stored their corn deep in the earth. They made pits. So somebody said, well, they could bury it. But then other children said they didn't think that was such a good way.
Some people they put it down the well.
Well, this was buried in the earth. Then they spoke about, through the questioning, putting it down in the basement. The Dutch had cellars in their home. Then, through further questioning, we went back one of the reasons Columbus was so anxious. Well, anyway, we finally got to the fact that the butter in those days was salt butter, and that helped to preserve it, besides keeping it in a cool place. Mm-hmm. But it was, we had to do quite a bit of thinking about it. But the example of the child who referred back to the Indian method of one of the methods of preserving food, and many others, though, didn't think that was such a good way.
And yet, at a simple, very, very simple level, a first grader, in discussing why we should wear our boots and rubbers on a trip to the Fulton Fish Market, said, well, because, you know, there are lots of fish there, and when the fish come in out of the water, you know, the fishermen or the people at the Fulton Fish Market will know the water runs out of the fish. Now, and my first reaction was, gee, you know, sort of taken back. Well, isn't this logical? It's just when you take things out of the water, they always drip, and there's always water coming. You know, the child was referring back to her past experiences, and someone started to laugh and said, "Oh, and I'm like, well, you know, let's get a lot of different ideas, and when we go, we'll find out, and we'll talk about them when we come back, and we'll see how many that we thought know, of these ideas, we'll go back over and we'll see whether we were right or not. But a lot of times with young children, and I think with old children too, my family, I live with a group of scientifically thinking men, my family, and logical thinkers, and they're always laughing at me. I'm supposed to be the dope of the family because I don't think logically. And when we go to test out some of the things, they find out that my simple logic works.
Your intuition.
Yeah, well, no, it's not the intuition. It's a simple logic, a more earthy logic than their intellectual one. And I think this happens with young children, that they think, or, you know, from their logical thinking. I feel, isn't that logical thinking, Norman? Well, if you think, this child thinking of the water running out, wouldn't you call this logical thinking? Yeah.
Incidentally, Mary, in the I brought along with me today a paper which your assistant made several years ago.
Oh, Portia?
Yes.
On the,
in which she put down a whole series of anecdotes of the children to illustrate the children's thinking. And I haven't had a chance to really go through it and to analyze it, but there are a lot of very interesting things here. One I just glanced at here was the thinking in the child's use of symbolism. They were discussing weather, and David Coffey said, "The weather is not cooperating. The sun is the teacher."
Yeah, that's typical.
But
you mentioned David Coffey. You know, another example was one day during lunch, we had been discussing numbers and you know, how men used to write numbers a long time ago and whatnot. And at lunchtime one day he said to me, "Buxenbaum, why do we say 12, 13, 14, 15? When we say 10, you know, 21, 22, and all the rest of them, we say the one after." So I brought it up as a problem because I thought this was, I think this is very logical. You know,
mm-hmm.
This is why so many children make mistakes and write 31 for 13. They don't mean 31, they mean 13. So we discussed it in the classroom. So I said to them, "Would it be better to say 1T1 and 1T2? And they all laughed. So I said, "Well, why are you laughing?" They said, "Because we're not used to it. But it would make more sense."
Mm-hmm.
You know, this kind of thing. So after they recognized this, I've seen less mistakes in writing teens. Because now they, when I point it out to them real quick, they say, "Oh, I made that mistake again," and they see it very quickly.
I wonder if it would be a valuable exercise to explore that problem a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, as I say, it's a big problem, but I'd like to.
Come on, let's take it off.
That's
a big problem.
Yeah, we're all
together. Well, some weeks ago, I decided that I would do a play for a small section of the class. And the play I selected was The Merchant of Venice. And we went around, we bought the books, and we started to talk about it and introduce it in the class. And last week, parents took very strong exception to this. They felt that their youngster particularly was not prepared to handle the stereotype that Shylock represented in The Merchant of Venice. We had a very long, cordial conversation over the telephone, and he finally said to me, "I don't care how sympathetically this play is presented, who acts it, whether they are Jewish or non-Jewish, or what it is. I am just appalled. I just don't think this is the kind of play for 12-year-olds.
Was it reenacted or just read?
Just read.
On what basis?
Charlotte?
Well, he felt that he didn't object to Shylock being a usurer, but he objected to Shylock's demanding a pound of flesh.
There's a whole play.
Yeah,
But anyway,
I pointed out to him that we had been dealing with stereotypes, that this would not be taught without developing the history of the play, without exploring the times to place this thing in perspective. And I pointed out that we did approximately the same thing with Huckleberry Finn. And he said, well, Huckleberry Finn is irrelevant, he doesn't want to discuss it, and this is, he was just interested in the Merchant of Venice. So, that's where it stood. The next thing I did, I came in and I put several questions on the board, and I opened up a discussion in the classroom about the reading of this play and how we handled Huckleberry Finn. And these were the conclusions of the youngsters. If the play were to be handled with the same sympathy and understanding as Huckleberry Finn, then it would be a good thing. That was one conclusion. Another conclusion was that we have been dealing almost exclusively with the problem of prejudice as with respect to the Negro, and that we need to see another side of this. Another conclusion was, I told them, these two things had been banned by the Board of Education. Of course, the Board of Education didn't go into the business of the pound of flesh. They merely went into the business that these were two stereotype figures, period, and that they were offensive to minority groups. The kids, rightly, I think, concluded that in a public school where they don't have the kind of preparation or the kind of climate that we have here, that this is perhaps a good thing. But they couldn't see that this would make a difference here in the downtown community. Certainly, they did not come away, I'm giving you the thought of the children, with the idea that Jim was representative of all Negroes, or that this had any relevance in thinking about Negroes. It was simply Jim in perspective. And of course, we had discussed before that one of the things we have to bring to this whole business of discussing stereotypes and the use of dialect is the author's intent. Right. Conclusion of the class was that we should do it. My reason for doing this in the class was I told the parent that I was talking to that I thought perhaps he was playing the children cheap, that they could handle this, that the preparation that was needed to place Shylock in perspective and to avoid hurting anybody would be done. His feeling was that, well, you just can't do anything with this, and the other thing is different. The other thing is not different because there were Negro children in the class who did not feel comfortable at first, who were not prepared for this, but they can see it now. Who in the first essays when they wrote, they wouldn't even refer to Jim or discuss it in any way whatsoever. I didn't pressure them, but just the continual sympathy and the talking and so forth and so on, they began to see that it was not the intent of Mark Twain to hurt anybody with this. Then this parent began to align other parents. Parent said to me, well, my feelings about this are ambivalent. Actually, I think if it were not for this parent, I wouldn't have had any objection from this particular parent. But she said to me, and I am quoting now verbatim, it is not that I feel that my daughter can't handle it, but there may be other children in the class that are not prepared, that cannot handle it. Now, I tell you in King's English, I think this is baloney. And I am slightly chagrined that I can't do it, but it's a tempest, this is a cooperative, and there is no compelling pedagogical reason why I just have to do that. And that's the way it stands at the moment.
Now,
it will not be taught.
I think that we ought to think of this as a problem to be discussed and ask ourselves, to get back to this book, one of the most important things to do when you're trying to solve a problem is to locate the problem itself. Now, what is the problem here?
Parents' feelings or attitudes? Is that
One, a parent's feelings.
Oh, may I say one more thing to sharpen that up? I said to him finally, I says, now, you see, we got involved in the textual analysis of this thing. And I explained to him from the very outset, none of these books are taught on this level. Many of these things, just as we discovered Myra in talking about the reproductive process and so forth, you give a kid a book and he is generally going to pick up only what's good for him. The damage is done when you get the kind of teacher, say, the public school system, who's going to twist the knife and whose purpose it is to reduce or embarrass a youngster. You see?
Now, is this the only problem we have?
Let me finish, Norman. So I said,
look, I think we know enough now to get to the problems, and then another important thing in critical thinking is to define the problems and to talk to them. So let's define them, then let's talk to them. Is this the only problem? How you handle the parent's attitude?
Would, if we were firmly convinced in what we were doing, then that wouldn't, the parent's attitude would not be a problem.
Well, don't you think that there is a problem as to how a teacher handles a parent complaint?
Oh, yes.
So there is a problem here.
Yes,
yeah.
But that isn't the main.
What is the main problem then?
Our function as teachers, I think the main problem is to see whether this is an appropriate kind of project for a seventh grade class. To re-examine it, since it's been called to our attention. It might not have been a parent, it might have been the director of a school or another teacher, or it might not have been.
Do
the
you
problem would still be there, mm-hmm. whether it was a parent or
whether
it was not.
Appropriate.
Yeah.
I think that the problem revolves around the fact that it was a parent, and I think the relationship of a parent to the school and to the building of curriculum and choosing a project is part of this.
Do you think that the assumption that this is appropriate material is not to be examined, and that it does,
that it
has no bearing here?
I think it has to be examined separately.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to do. You see, one of the important we are trying to learn about thinking from this, and I find that one of the greatest sources of confusion is when problems are not clearly defined and people are talking to different things. And it is, I agree with you, it is very important to separate them. And I think that we should separate them. Now, is there any other basic problem here? Parents feeling an attitude to see whether this is an appropriate project apart from who complained. Anything else? Now, which of these two problems do you think that we should approach first?
The
appropriateness.
The assumption. Examine our assumption that this is appropriate material. All right? So this would be the first problem to take. Now, my approach to this, this was not part of the curriculum, and it had not been discussed in terms of curriculum planning, so I had no preconceived approach, and I have taken the position that I have an open mind on the subject, because I have not read this book for a long time.
Would it be necessary really to read it to discuss its appropriateness?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I
well,
think
that's
I think
at the end of the discussion.
I don't think so, because I think that there are also other factors that we can look at, so that when we read with more purpose.
I would even question whether I'll introduce Shakespeare in the 17th.
Yeah. Well, but let's take this. Let's
not
take this.
Taught to the whole class. This is a selected group of students who function on a very high level. Six students.
Let's take When we feel that we are making judgments beyond, for instance, if, when we're making judgments in areas where we are not informed, we'll sort of check each other up on it. In other words, if we start deciding one thing or another about this book without having read it, then we'll, you know, this is not critical thinking. But let's see if there aren't some things that might be said. As I said before, my own feeling was that I was not sure myself. I have been following very closely controversies that are going on, and I know that Joseph Papp is planning to put this on in Central Park, which tells me that an intelligent, liberal-minded person is taking this approach. I also know that there has been a storm of protests that Jewish organizations have bitterly protested, and that he's getting, he's being swamped with protests. So that my position, now I'm in critical thinking, I'm defining how I began to think as a director here. That this is an open subject. Then I also thought this, that the analogy between the Huck Finn situation and this, I would question for this reason, that Huck Finn, I know, and this I'm not venturing beyond my knowledge of the two books, Huck Finn, in a sense, has a stereotype. Jim is a slave, he's subservient, he's...
superstitious.
Well, that isn't necessarily a stereotype. Because there has been a stereotype, something like that, it verges closely on it. Jim is a Jim is a positive character. He's not a stereotype in the sense that he has dignity, and that he desires to be free. He isn't an Uncle Tom. He desires to be free. He has dignity. The relationship between Jim and Huck is a very positive one. The book has been studied at a time when the whole class is studying about slavery, so that they see this one book within a whole perspective. I can't say the same about the Merchant of Venice. The whole class is not sharing in this. There are Jewish children who are reading and Jewish children who are not reading. If there are concerns, these concerns are not being shared by the whole class. The class is not, whatever is done now, it's not analogous to, a study of Negro history where the class is immersed in the subject. They have positive, they have a great deal of experiential basis for developing positive attitudes toward a minority and seeing a stereotype in perspective. In The Merchant of Venice, the character being examined is not a positive character. The children are being introduced to this kind of situation. And now I'm going to stop right here, because I hope that nobody is making assumptions beyond what I am saying. I'm trying to think this thing through, and I think one of the problems when we discuss is that many people jump ahead and make assumptions. I'm describing my process of thinking in these initial stages. And I felt that from this point of view, that the two situations are not analogous. I also felt that at this point, to start something with children and then to drop it is bad. Because, I'm really verging onto the other problem of how to, I'm sorry, I'm getting off the question of whether this is an appropriate project. I think I should stay on that and not get on the question of the parent and the complaint. I started out with questions. I took this analogy and I felt that it was not a correct analogy, and that as far as our thinking and our drawing of conclusions for the future was that, and I'm not talking about the present situation, because here a controversy is involved, and I think we have to think of that specially. But as far as the future was concerned, that this would not be an appropriate thing to do. I also felt that in the eighth grade, in terms of curriculum planning and seeing these things, in the eighth grade, the youngsters spend a great deal of time studying American industry. They study New York City, the garment industry, the Jewish people coming here. They read Shalom Aleichem. They get positive identification with the Jewish culture, and that coming within that particular framework, whatever it is, and I'm not passing judgment on the book, but for whatever it is, it would be a more appropriate place to teach it. Now, this is thinking so far on the subject of whether this is an appropriate project for the seventh grade.
I'd like to ask two questions, Norman. Because Huck Finn is taught within the context of social studies that this necessarily make for positive identification as far as Jim goes. And number two, since The Merchant of Venice was chosen as a special project for six selected children who have been reading Moliere, Paine, Forrester, and his passage to India, this kind of thing, and writing papers on a very high critical level, does it follow then that if you're going to do any enrichment and any outside reading, that it must of necessity be tied up with curriculum?
No, that isn't what I said.
Well, I said
when you have enrichment, which involves a stereotype and certain dangers, that you do it within the context. I didn't say that all enrichment should be done within the context. You see, that's where you slightly misunderstood my point. But where a problem like this involving a stereotype, that it should be within the context of looking at the area from many points of view.
Could I say something, Bill? Because I think that the reason I would criticize it would be for this point, that how can you explain to them why the prejudice? You can explain to them through their being immersed in American history at that time why the prejudice against the Negro people. Now, if I bring up prejudice against the Jewish people or prejudice against the Irish people, I would like to say that I agree with Norman that it has to come, it should come in the curriculum at a time when they're getting a positive presentation of the contributions of these groups. But then, why the prejudice? And I think it would be hard to explain to seventh graders why there was a prejudice against the Jews at that time in history, because they don't have enough feeling for the times and the situation. It would take a whole unit, you see, of work to give them any deep understanding of it.
For a class or for selected students? You see, Una,
well,
against this background, we had begun to talk early in the term. Why the Chinese are apparently all laundry. Why the Jewish people were in the garment industry.
But the Chinese aren't all laundry.
No, I said apparently. This is an image that people have.
Yeah.
We know that. But why these things? And why, for example, during this time, in the 1500s, the Jew was forced in a position where one of the things that he could do was lend money, usury. The other avenues of public endeavor were closed to him.
Were all Jews usurers in that time?
Not all Jews, but we're dealing in generalities now, aren't we?
But it was a disproportionate number. I think that he certainly had a point there, that much beyond their numbers, Jews were involved in money lending.
That's the important thing because you
see. Well, he would handle it sympathetically. I think this is the base. If I may interrupt, Bill, you were talking. I think that that's an important consideration that hasn't been dwelt on sufficiently. That this is a touchy topic. There's no question about it. The fact that we're discussing it now, and that there has been such controversy on it, is testament to that. But we also have to consider a person who, and a milieu, this school, which is sympathetically inclined, which is anti-prejudice, very strongly so, and which has handled things that ordinary channels haven't handled. The fact that the public schools had to ban both books is the result of pressure by minority organizations because the books weren't handled properly by the teachers and the school situation, the public school situation. We can't expect, for example, that Red China or problems of socialism are going to be handled sympathetically in the public schools, and they're not. So the best that a liberal teacher can do in the public school situation is to run away from it. He doesn't handle it. That's the best thing he can do. He violates his own convictions. Here we can handle it. I've been teaching China. The kids had a debate about should Red China be admitted to the UN. It was wonderful. Kids were for it, kids were against it. You couldn't do that in a public school setup. Here you can. And I think that is a very important thing. Now, I'd like to say other things, but I know others want to speak.
But could I just say, Sam, that I would agree with you, see, because I think with the 8th grade now you can teach Merchant of Venice.
Why
see?
Not the 7th grade?
Because we have gone back into why the Jewish people came here. We have spent 8 weeks studying,
We haven't had that. Yet we have instances where we speak against anti-Semitism. We don't have to have any curriculum. Because this is a realistic thing that the kids are faced with all the time. It comes up in real life. Kids shouldn't be isolated from this kind of discussion.
You know, just a minute. Let me again define what we're talking about, because sometimes we're not quite talking the same point. None of us are saying at this point that this kind of material should not be handled, right? I haven't heard anybody say that. So I don't think we need to talk against that. Some of us are questioning whether this should be handled at this point with a part of the group in this particular way. That's what is being questioned at this point. And I think that, and also we are not discussing this in terms of a parent's complaint. We are discussing it in terms of the question itself. And I think that we can, I think this is a very good exercise of critical thinking, because people's feelings are very much involved. And I think that many of us are feeling very angry at parents. And this is part of our discussion of whether this should be, say, at this point, it's a discussion of whether this is appropriate in the 7th grade or the 8th grade. And so let's keep to this discussion. Yes, Bob? All right, Pearl.
I was wondering, would we be discussing this if there hadn't been a complaint from a parent?
But Pearl, our question is, can we discuss this calmly and objectively with the knowledge of this, but aside from that, because this is what I've been trying to do in the last day or so.
Okay.
We listed two problems.
Yeah. Yes, Bob?
Criticisms of different productions of Merchant of Venice where they indicate a different approach to the play, where in one
was
play,
done on Second Avenue in Yiddish, incidentally.
Well,
I saw it.
That's
something.
Well, certainly the Jew was handled sympathetically in that production.
Yeah.
And I remember Morris Karnofsky doing it. Now, Morris Karnofsky would not lend himself to anything where he would feel that it would be anti-Semitic. Now, I can also conceive that in some productions, it could be anti-Semitic. So I repeat, it depends on who's handling it.
Yeah.
And I have sufficient faith in it.
Oh, well.
Yes.
I think we need to get back to the problem again. There were several aspects about the appropriateness for the grade and the fact that it was a select group, it wasn't the whole class that was sharing in this experience, whereas if it will postpone perhaps to the 8th grade or the 9th grade, the whole class would be ready to share in this.
Well, may I bring something up?
Yeah.
Well, what you have to decide, what criteria do you use to decide if a class is ready?
Well,
and a group
do we?
Well,
that's a good angle.
Go
I don't see what they set up to decide this.
Well, I'm not